Neil told me they'd agreed to allow me into their circle, but I had to prove myself first. They wanted access to a computer system called the ARC, which was the system of digital equipment used by the development group for RISTIS-E. He told me, if you can hack into the ARC, we'll figure you're good enough for us to share information with. And to get me started, Neil already had a dial-up number that he had been given by a friend who worked on the RISTIS-E development team. He gave me that challenge because he knew there was no way in the world I'd be able to do it. Maybe it really was impossible, but I sure was going to try. The modem number brought up a log-on banner on the ARC, but of course you had to enter a valid account number and password. How could I get those credentials? I had a plan I thought might work, but to get started I would need to know the name of a system administrator, not someone in the development group itself, but one of the people who managed the internal computer systems at Digital. I called the switchboard for the facility in Merrimack, New Hampshire, where the ARC was located, and asked to be connected to the computer room. Which one? The switchboard lady asked. Oops. I had never thought to research which lab the ARC was in. I said, for RISTIS-E development. Oh, you mean the raised floor lab. I'll connect you. Large computer systems were often mounted on raised floors so all the heavy-duty cabling could be run underneath. A lady came on the line. I was taking a gamble, but they wouldn't be able to trace the call, so even if they got suspicious, I had little to lose. Is the PDP 1170 for the ARC located in this lab? I asked, giving the name of the most powerful DEC minicomputer of the time, which I figured the development group would have to be using. She assured me it was. This is Anton Chernoff, I brazenly claimed. Chernoff was one of the key developers on the RISTIS-E development team, so I was taking a big risk that she wouldn't be familiar with his voice. I'm having trouble logging in to one of my accounts on the ARC.
You'll have to contact Jerry Covert.
I asked for his extension. She didn't hesitate to give it to me, and when I reached him, I said, Hey, Jerry, this is Anton, figuring that even if he didn't know Chernoff personally, he was almost certain to know the name. Hey, how you doing? He answered jovially, obviously not familiar enough with Chernoff in person to know that I didn't sound like him. Okay, I said, but did you guys delete one of my accounts? I created an account for testing some code last week, and now I can't log in. He asked what the account login was. I knew from experience that under RISTIS-E, account numbers were a combination of the project number and the programmer number, such as 1-119, each number running up to 254. Privileged accounts always had the project number of 1, and I had discovered that the RISTIS-E development team used programmer numbers starting at 200. I told Jerry that my test account was 1-119, crossing my fingers that it wasn't assigned to anyone. It was a lucky guess. He checked and told me there wasn't any 1-119 account. Damn, I answered. Somebody must have removed it. Can you recreate it for me? What Chernoff wanted, Chernoff got. No problem, Jerry said. What password do you want? I spotted a jar of strawberry jelly in the kitchen cabinet across from me. I told him, make it jelly. In hardly more than a blink, he said, okay, all done. I was stoked, the adrenaline running high. I could hardly believe it could have been so easy. But would it really work? From my computer, I called the dial-in number my would-be mentor Neil had given me. The call connected, and this text appeared. RISTIS, Volume 7.0-07, The ARC, Job 25, KB42, 05, July 80, 1117 a.m., Number 1-119. Password. Dial-up password. Damn, damn, damn. I dialed Jerry Covert back, again as Chernoff. Hey, I'm dialing in from home, and it's asking for a dial-up password. You didn't get it in your email? It's buffoon. I tried again, and I was in. Before anything else, I started grabbing all the passwords for the guys in the development team. When I got together with Neil, I told him, getting into the ARC was a snap. I have every RISTIS-E developer's password. He rolled his eyes with an expression that said, what's this guy been smoking? He dialed the modem number and got to the ARC's login banner. Telling him to move over, I typed the logon credentials and got the ready prompt. Satisfied, Neil? I asked. He couldn't believe what he was seeing. It was like I had shown him a winning lottery ticket. After they had picked my brain for details of how I had gained access, Neil, Dave, and a few other friends went to a company called PSI near Culver City, where they had the newest, fastest modems running at 1,200 baud, four times as fast as the 300 baud modems the rest of us had. The guys started downloading the RISC-ISE source code. The old adage says there's no honor among thieves. Instead of taking me into their confidence and sharing information, they downloaded the source code for RISC-ISE and kept it to themselves. I learned later that these bastards actually called DEC and told them the ARC had been hacked and gave my name as the hacker. Total betrayal. I had no suspicion these guys would dream of snitching on me, especially when they had reaped such rich rewards. It was the first time of many instances to come when the people I trusted would betray me. At 17, I was still in high school but dedicated to working on what might be called a PhD in RISC-ISE hacking. I would find targets by checking want ads for companies looking to hire a computer person experienced with RISC-ISE. I'd call, claiming to be from DEC field support, and was usually able to talk a system administrator into revealing dial-up numbers and privileged account passwords. In December 1980, I ran into a kid named Micah Hirschman, whose father happened to have an account with a company called Bloodstock Research, which used a RISC-ISE system. I assume the company kept historical records on the bloodlines of racehorses for breeders and bettors. I used the Hirschman account to connect to Bloodstock Research so I could exploit a security flaw and gain access to a privileged account. Then Micah and I played with the operating system to teach ourselves about it, basically for kicks. The episode blew up in our faces. Micah logged in late one night without me, and Bloodstock spotted the break-in and alerted the FBI, telling them that the attack had been through the Hirschman account. The feds paid Mr. Hirschman a visit. He denied knowing anything about the attack. When they pressured him, he fingered his son. Micah fingered me. I was in my bedroom on the second floor of our condo, online, hacking into the Pacific Telephone switches over a dial-up modem. Hearing a knock at the front door, I opened my window and called down. "Who is it?" The answer was one that I would come to have nightmares about. "Robin Brown, FBI." My heart began pounding. Mom called to me. "Who is it?" "A man who says he's from the FBI?" I called back. Mom just laughed. She didn't know who it was, but she didn't think it could possibly be the FBI. I was in a panic, already hanging up the phone from the computer modem cradle and stashing under the bed the TI-700 computer terminal Louis DePayne had lent me for a few weeks. Back then, before the days of the personal computer, all I had was a terminal and a modem that I was using to connect to a system at a company or university. No computer monitor, the responses to my commands would print out on a long roll of thermal paper. I was flashing on the fact that I had a ton of that thermal paper under my bed, filled with data that would show I had been hacking for many hours a week into the telephone company computers and switches, as well as a load of computers at private firms. When I went downstairs, the agent offered me his hand, and I shook it. "I busted Stanley Rifkin," he told me, understanding that I'd know whom he was talking about, the guy who had pulled off the biggest theft of its kind in history, stealing $10 million from Security Pacific National Bank by a wire transfer ruse. The agent thought that would scare me, except I knew that Rifkin had been caught only because he had returned to the States and then blabbed about what he had done. Otherwise, he'd still be living abroad in luxury. But this guy was a Fed, and there still weren't any federal laws covering the kind of computer break-ins I was doing. He said, "You can get 25 years if you continue messing with the phone company." I knew he was powerless, just trying to scare me. It didn't work. As soon as he left, I went right back online. I didn't even burn the printouts. Yes, it was stupid. I was already incorrigible. If the agent's visit didn't give me any chills, my mother's reaction was not what you might expect. To her, the whole thing was like a dumb joke. What harm could a boy come to just from playing with a computer at home? She had no concept of what I was up to. The thrill and satisfaction of doing things I wasn't supposed to do were just too great. I was consumed by a fascination with the technology of phones and computers. I felt like an explorer, traveling cyberspace without limitations, sneaking into systems for the pure thrill and satisfaction, outsmarting engineers with years of experience, figuring out how to bypass security obstacles, learning how things worked. It wasn't long before I began experiencing some turbulence from the authorities. Micah had left shortly after for a trip to Paris. The Air France flight had been in the air for a couple of hours when an announcement came over the PA system. "Mr. Micah Hirschman, please turn on your stewardess call button." When he did, a stewardess came to him and said, "The pilot wants to speak with you in the cockpit." You can just imagine his surprise. He was led to the cockpit. The co-pilot spoke into the radio to say Micah was present, then handed him a microphone. A voice over the radio said, "This is FBI Special Agent Robin Brown. The Bureau has learned that you have left the country headed for France. Why are you going to France?" The whole situation made no sense. Micah gave his answer and the agent grilled him for a few minutes. It turned out the feds thought that Micah and I were pulling off some Stanley Rifkin-style big computer hack, maybe setting up a phony transfer of millions from a U.S. bank to some other bank in Europe. It was like a scene from a caper movie. And I loved the thrill of it. After getting a taste of that kind of excitement, I was hooked, and I hungered for more. In high school, my brain was so occupied with hacking and freaking that I had little attention or motivation left for the classroom. Happily, I discovered a solution that was one big step better than becoming a dropout or waiting for the Los Angeles school district to show its displeasure by kicking me out. Passing the GED exam would give me the equivalent of a high school diploma without wasting any more of my time or my teacher's time. I signed up for the exam, which turned out to be way easier than I had expected. About an eighth grade level, I thought. What could be better than becoming a college student studying computers, working toward a degree while feeding my insatiable thirst for computer knowledge? In the summer of 1981, at the age of 17, I enrolled at Pierce College, a two-year school in nearby Woodland Hills. The school's computer room manager, Gary Levi, recognized my passion. He took me under his wing, giving me special status by allowing me to have a privileged account on the Ristis E system. His gift had an expiration date. He left the school. Not long after, the computer science chair, one Chuck Alvarez, noticed I was logged into a privileged account and told me to sign off immediately. I explained that Levi had given me permission, but it didn't wash. He booted me from the computer lab. My dad went in with me for a meeting with Alvarez, who offered as an excuse, "Your son already knows so much about computers that there is nothing Pierce College can teach him." I dropped out. I'd lost my access to a great system, but in the late 1970s and the beginning of the 1980s, the world of personal computing went through a dramatic transition period, bringing the first desktop machines that included a monitor or even had one built in. The Commodore PET, the Apple II, and the first IBM PC began to make computers a tool for everyone, and to make computers much more convenient for heavy users, including computer hackers. I couldn't have been happier. Louis DePayne had been my closest hacking and freaking partner just about from that first time he called and said he wanted to get together and learn from me. Even though he was 5 years older, which at that stage of life makes quite a difference, we shared the same boyish exhilaration from phone freaking and hacking, and we shared the same goals: access to companies' computers, access to passwords, access to information that we weren't supposed to have. I never damaged anyone's computer files or made any money from the access I gained. As far as I know, Lewis didn't either. And we trusted each other, even though his values were, well, different from mine. A prime example was the U.S. leasing hack. I got into U.S. leasing's system using a tactic that was so ridiculously easy, I should have been embarrassed to try it. It went like this. I would call the company I'd targeted, ask for their computer room, make sure I was talking to a system administrator, and tell him, "This is," whatever fictitious name popped into my head at that moment, "from deck support. We've discovered a catastrophic bug in your version of Ristis E. You could lose data." This is a very powerful social engineering technique because the fear of losing data is so great that most people won't hesitate to cooperate. With the person sufficiently scared, I'd say, "We can patch your system without interfering with your operations." By that point, the guy, or sometimes lady, could hardly wait to give me the dial-up phone number and access to the system manager account. If I got any pushback, I'd just say something like, "Okay, we'll send it to you in the mail," and move on to try another target. The system administrator at U.S. Leasing gave me the password to the system manager account without a blink. I went in, created a new account, and patched the operating system with a backdoor, software code that sets me up so I'd be able to gain covert access whenever I want to get back in. I shared details of the backdoor with Lewis when we next spoke. At the time, Lewis was dating a wannabe hacker who sometimes went by the name of Susan Thunder, and who later told one interviewer that in those days she had sometimes worked as a prostitute, but only to raise money for buying computer equipment. I still roll my eyes when I think about that line. Anyway, Lewis told Susan that I had broken into U.S. Leasing and gave her the credentials. Or maybe, as he later claimed, he didn't give them to her, but she saw them written on a notepad he had left alongside his computer. Shortly after, the two of them had a falling out and parted company, I guess, with some bad feelings. She then took revenge on me. To this day, I don't know why I was the target, unless perhaps she thought Lewis had broken up with her so he could spend more time with me, hacking, and so blamed me for the breakup. Whatever the reason, she reportedly used the stolen credentials to get into the U.S. Leasing computer systems. The later stories about the incident said she had destroyed many of their files, and that she had sent messages to all their printers to print out over and over until they ran out of paper. Mitnick was here, Mitnick was here, fuck you, fuck you. What really burned me about this whole affair was that in a later plea agreement, the government insisted on including this act that I didn't commit. I was faced with a choice between confessing to this abusive, ridiculous act and going to juvenile prison. Susan waged a vendetta against me for some time, disrupting my phone service and giving the phone company orders to disconnect my telephone number. My one small act of revenge came about by chance. Once, in the middle of a phone company hack, I needed one telephone line that would ring and ring unanswered. I dialed the number of a payphone I happened to know by heart. In one of those small world coincidences that happen to most of us now and then, Susan Thunder, who lived nearby, was walking past that particular phone booth just at that moment. She picked up the telephone and said, "Hello." I recognized her voice. I said, "Susan, it's Kevin. I just want you to know I'm watching every move you make. Don't fuck with me." I hope it scared the hell out of her for weeks. I'd been having fun, but my evading the law wasn't going to last forever. By May 1981, still age 17, I had transferred my extracurricular studies to UCLA. In the computer lab, the students were there to do homework assignments or to learn about computers and programming. I was there to hack into remote computers because we couldn't afford a computer at home, so I had to find computer access at places like universities. Of course, the machines in the student computer lab had no external access. You could dial out from the modem at each station, but only to another campus phone number, not to an outside number, which meant they were essentially worthless for what I wanted to do. No sweat. On the wall of the computer room was a single telephone with no dial. It was for incoming calls only. Just as I had in Mr. Christ's computer lab in high school, I would pick up the handset and flick the switch hook, which had the same effect as dialing, flashing 9 times in quick succession, equivalent to dialing the number 9, would get me a dial tone for an outside line. Then I would flash 10 times, equivalent to dialing O for an operator. When the operator came on the line, I'd ask her to call me back at the phone number for the modem at the computer terminal I was using. The computer terminals in the lab at that time did not have internal modems. Instead, to make modem connection, you had to place the telephone handset into an adjacent acoustic coupler, which sent signals from the modem into the telephone handset and out over the phone lines. When the operator called back on the modem telephone, I'd answer the call and ask her to dial a phone number for me. I used this method to dial into numerous businesses that used DEC PDP-11s running RISTIS-E. I was able to social engineer their dial-ups and system credentials using the DEC field support ruse. Since I didn't have a computer of my own, I was like a drifter moving from one college campus to another, to get the dose of computer access that I so desperately wanted. I felt such an adrenaline rush driving to a college campus to get online. I would drive over the speed limit for 45 minutes, even if it meant only 15 minutes of computer time. I guess it just never occurred to me that a student at one of these computer labs might overhear what I was doing and blow the whistle on me. Not until the evening when I was sitting at a terminal in a lab at UCLA, I heard a clamor, looked up, and saw a swarm of campus cops rushing in and heading straight for me. I was trying hard to appear concerned but confident, a kid who didn't know what the fuss was all about. They pulled me up out of the chair and clamped on a pair of handcuffs, closing them much too tightly. Yes, California now had a law that criminalized hacking, but I was still a juvenile, so I wasn't facing prison time. Yet I was panicked, scared to death. The duffel bag in my car was crammed with printouts revealing all the companies I had been breaking into. If they searched my car and found the treasure trove of printouts and understood what it was, I'd be facing a lot worse than any punishment they might hand out for using the school's computers when I wasn't a student. One of the campus cops located my car after seizing my car keys and found the bag of hacking contraband. From there, they hustled me to a police station on campus, which was like being under arrest, and told me I was being detained for trespassing. They called my mom to come get me. In the end, UCLA didn't find anybody who could make sense of my printouts. The university never filed any charges, no action at all, beyond referring my case to the county probation department, which could have petitioned juvenile court to hear the case, but didn't. Perhaps I was untouchable. Perhaps I could keep on with what I was doing, facing a shakeup now and then, but never really having to worry. Though it had scared the hell out of me, once again, I had dodged a bullet. 4. Escape Artist. Over Memorial Day weekend, 1981, Louis DePayne and I joined a bunch of phone freakers who were gathering for a party. The quotation marks are because who besides a six-year-old having a birthday or a bunch of geeks would choose a Shakey's Pizza Parlor as a place to gather and frolic? Something like 24 people showed up, each one almost as much of a nerd as the worst of the ham radio enthusiasts. But some of them had good technical know-how, which made me feel I wasn't entirely wasting my time. The conversation inevitably got around to one of my favorite targets, Cosmos, the computer system for mainframe operations, the Pacific Telephone mission-critical system that could bestow so much power on any freaker who could access it. Louis and I already had access to Cosmos, one of the first Pacific Telephone computers I had hacked into, but probably only a few of the others had gotten in at the time, and I wasn't going to tell them how I had. As we started talking, I realized the building that housed Cosmos was nearby, only a few miles away. I figured if a few of us went over there and had a go at a little dumpster diving, we might find some useful information. Louis was always ready for just about anything. We invited only one other guy, a fellow named Mark Ross, who was very familiar with phone systems and someone we thought we could trust. En route, we swung by an all-night pharmacy and picked up gloves and flashlights, then on to the Cosmos building. The dumpster diving turned up a few interesting items, but nothing of real value. After about an hour, discouraged, I suggested, "Why don't we see if we can get inside?" They both wanted me to go in, see if I could social engineer the guard, and then send a touch-tone signal from my handheld ham radio. Nothing doing. We were going to be the Three Musketeers or nothing. We walked in. The guard was a young guy, the kind who looked like he might enjoy a toke pretty often. I said, "Hey, how you doing? We're out late. I work here. I wanted to show my friends where I work." "Sure," he said. "Just sign in." Didn't even ask for ID. Smooth. We'd been calling departments, analyzing phone company operations for so long that we knew where the Cosmos employees worked. Room 108 kept coming up in Pacific Telephone Communications. We found our way to it. Cosmos. The mother lode. The jackpot. A folder on the wall held sheets of paper listing dial-up numbers for every wire center in Southern California. They looked exactly like those glossy brochures in a doctor's office where the sticker says, "Take one." I couldn't believe our luck. This was a real treasure, one of the things I most coveted. Each central office has one or more wire centers. The telephone exchanges in each central office are assigned to a particular wire center. Armed with the list of dial-up numbers for each wire center and login credentials, I'd have the ability to control any phone line in Pacific Telephone's Southern California service area. It was an exciting find, but I needed passwords to other administrative accounts as well. I wandered through the offices around the Cosmos room, opening folders and looking into desk drawers. I opened one folder and found a sheet labeled Passwords. Whoa. Fantastic. I was grinning from ear to ear. We should have left then. But I spotted a set of Cosmos manuals that would be crammed with gotta-have information. The temptation was irresistible. These manuals could tell us everything we needed to know, from how to make inquiries with the cryptic commands used by phone company personnel to every aspect of how the system worked. Today, you would be able to find all this with a Google search, but back then, it was stored only in these manuals. I told the guys, let's take the manuals to a copy shop, run off a copy for each of us, and then return the manuals before people start coming back to work in the morning. The guard didn't even comment that we had come in empty-handed and were leaving with several manuals, including several stuffed into a briefcase that Lewis had spotted in one of the offices. It was the most stupid decision of my early life. We drove around looking for a copy shop, but couldn't find one. And of course, the ordinary copy shops weren't open at 2 o'clock a.m. And then we decided it was too risky anyway to go back into the building a second time to return the manuals, even after the shift change. My ever-reliable, plausible story-on-the-spot mechanism wasn't coming up with a single believable explanation to offer. So I took the manuals home with me, but I had a bad feeling about them. Into several hefty trash bags they went, and Lewis took possession for me and hid them somewhere. I didn't want to know. Even though Lewis wasn't hooked up with Susan Thunder anymore, he was still associating with her, and he still had that big mouth of his. Somehow, incapable of keeping quiet, even about things that could get him or his friends in deep trouble, he told her about the manuals. She ratted us out to the phone company. On a hot summer evening several days later, as I pull out of the parking lot to drive home from my job as a telephone receptionist at the Stephen S. Wise Temple, I pass a Ford Crown Victoria with three men inside. Why do law enforcement guys always drive the same model of car? Did nobody ever figure out that it makes them as obvious as if they had undercover cops painted on the side? I speed up to see if they'll U-turn and follow. Yes. Shit. But maybe it's just a coincidence. I pick up speed, rolling onto the ramp for the I-405 headed for San Fernando Valley. The Crown Vic is catching up. As I watch in my rearview mirror, an arm reaches out and places a set of cop car flashers on the roof and the lights start blinking. Oh, shit, why are they pulling me over? The thought of gunning it races through my mind. A high-speed chase? Insane. No way am I going to try to run. I pull over. The car pulls up behind me. The three guys leap out. They start running toward me. They're drawing their guns. They're shouting, "Get out of the car!" In an instant, I'm in handcuffs. Once again, they're closed painfully tight. One of the guys shouts in my ear, "You're going to stop fucking around with the phone company. We're going to teach you a lesson." I'm so scared I start crying. Another car pulls up. The driver hops out and runs toward us. He's shouting at the cops, "Search his car for the bomb. He's got a logic bomb." Now, I'm practically laughing through my tears. A logic bomb is a piece of software, but these guys don't seem to know that. They think I'm carrying something that can blow everybody up. They start grilling me. "Where are the manuals?" I tell them, "I'm a juvenile. I want to call my lawyer." Instead, they treated me like a terrorist, taking me to a police station in Pasadena, about a 45-minute drive away, and parading me to a holding cell. No bars, just a small room like a cement coffin with a huge steel door that no sounds could penetrate. I tried to get my one phone call, but the cops refused. Apparently, juveniles didn't have any constitutional rights. Finally, a probation officer showed up to interview me. Although he had the power to release me to my parents, the cops convinced him that I was what today might be described as the Hannibal Lecter of computer hacking. I was transferred in handcuffs to Juvenile Hall in East Los Angeles overnight and brought into court for an appearance the next day. My mom and dad were there, both trying to get me released. The Pasadena Star News ran a lengthy article about me. That was followed by an even bigger story in the Sunday Los Angeles Times. Of course, since I was a juvenile, they weren't allowed to publish my name. They did anyway, and it would have consequences for me later. As a side note to this story, I would later find out that the guy shouting about the logic bomb was Steve Cooley, the assistant district attorney assigned to my case. Today, he is top dog, the district attorney for Los Angeles County. My aunt, Chickie Leventhal, who has long run an operation called Chickie's Bail Bonds, knows Cooley. Some years ago, after my book, The Art of Deception, was published, she offered it as one of the prizes for a fundraiser to benefit a children's charity that Cooley attended. When she told him I was her nephew, he said he wanted a copy of the book. He asked if I'd sign it and write in it, "We've both come a very long way." Indeed we have. I was glad to do it for him. The juvenile court judge who heard my case seemed puzzled. I was charged with being a hacker, but I hadn't stolen and used any credit card numbers, nor had I sold any proprietary software or trade secrets. I had just hacked into computers and phone company systems for the sheer entertainment. The judge didn't seem to understand why I would do such things without profiting from my actions. The idea that I was doing it for fun didn't seem to make sense. Since he wasn't sure exactly what I was doing once I got into the computers and phone systems, he figured maybe he was missing something. Maybe I was taking money or making a profit in some high-tech way he didn't comprehend. The whole thing probably made him suspicious. The truth was, I broke into the phone system for the same reason another kid might break into an abandoned house down the block, just to check it out. The temptation to explore and find out what's in there was too great. Sure, there might be danger, but taking a risk was part of the fun. Because this was the first hacking case ever, there was more than a little confusion over exactly what the district attorney could charge me with. While some of the charges were legitimate, having to do with my breaking into and entering the phone company, others were not. The prosecutor claimed that in my hacking, I had damaged computer systems at U.S. Leasing. I hadn't, but it wouldn't be the last time I was accused of this. The juvenile court judge sent me to the California Youth Authority, CYA, reception facility in Norwalk, California, for a 90-day psychological evaluation to determine whether I was suited for incarceration in that agency's facilities. I've never been so intimidated. The other kids were there for crimes like assault, rape, murder, and gang hits. These were juveniles, sure, but they were even more violent and dangerous because they felt invincible. We each had our own room and were kept locked up in it, let out in small groups for only 3 hours each day. I wrote a daily letter home, beginning each with Kevin Mitnick held hostage, day one, day two, day three. Even though Norwalk is actually in L.A. County, it was an hour and a half drive for my mom and her mother, my Gram. Loyal beyond my deserving, they came every weekend, bringing food. They would always leave their homes early enough to be the first in line. My 18th birthday came and went while I was being held in Norwalk. Though the California Youth Authority would still have custody of me for some time, I was no longer a juvenile. I knew that for any further offenses, I would be charged as an adult and could, if convicted, be sent to prison. At the end of my 90 days, the California Youth Authority recommended that I be released to go home on probation, and the judge accepted the recommendation. My assigned probation officer was an extraordinarily obese lady named Mary Ridgway, who I thought found pleasure only in eating and in lashing out at the kids in her charge. Her phone stopped working one day. Months later, I learned that after the phone company fixed her line, they told her they didn't know why it had gone dead. She figured it must have been me and put a notation in my record that would become accepted as fact and used against me. Too many times in those days, unexplained failures in technology anywhere would be attributed to me. Along with probation came psychological counseling. I was sent to a clinic that treated sex offenders and other hardcore addicts. My counselor was a doctoral intern from Great Britain named Roy Escapa. When I explained that I was on probation for phone freaking, his eyes lit up. "Have you heard about ITT?" The initials stood for International Telephone and Telegraph. "Of course," I said. "Do you know where I can get any codes?" He was asking me about ITT access codes. Once you had a code, you could simply dial a local ITT access number and punch in the access code, followed by the long-distance number you wanted to call. If you used someone else's code, your call would be billed to that poor subscriber, and you wouldn't have to pay a cent. I smiled. Roy and I were going to get along just fine. During my court-ordered counseling sessions in 1981 and 1982, we basically just chatted and became good friends. Roy told me that what I had been doing was exceedingly tame compared to the crimes of his other patients. Years later, in 1988, when I got into trouble again, he wrote a letter to the judge explaining that I was driven to hack not by malicious or criminal motives, but by a compulsive disorder. I was, he said, addicted to hacking. As far as my attorney and I have been able to determine, this was the first time that hacking had ever been labeled that way and placed on par with a drug, alcohol, gambling, or sex addiction. When the judge heard the diagnosis of addiction and realized that I suffered from an ailment, she accepted our plea agreement. On December 22, 1982, 3 days before Christmas, nearly midnight, I was in the computer room in Salvatore Hall on the campus of USC, the University of Southern California, near downtown L.A., with my hacking buddy Lenny DiCiccio, a lanky, athletic six-footer who was to become a close, trusted hacking partner and future double-crosser. We had been hacking into the USC systems over dial-up modems, but were frustrated with their slow speeds. A little exploring had turned up the tempting fact that a building called Salvatore Hall had a group of DEC TOPS 20 mainframes that were connected to the ARPANET, the precursor of the Internet. Being on campus would give us much faster access to systems on campus. Using a newly discovered vulnerability that Lenny had managed to pickpocket from Dave Compel at a DECUS, Digital Equipment Computer Users Society, conference we attended a week earlier, we had already gained full system, or wheel, privileges on all of the student DEC 20s. But we wanted to get as many passwords as possible. Even though we had system administrator privileges, the system was configured to encrypt all passwords. No sweat. I started searching through the email accounts of staff members who had wheel privileges. Hunting around inside the system led me to the mail of the accounting department, which was responsible for issuing usernames and passwords. When I searched that account's email, it was chock full of messages handing out usernames and passwords in plain text. Jackpot. Knowing it was risky, I sent the entire email file to the printer. About 15 minutes after I gave the print command, an operator dropped a thick printout into the student bin. In a room full of students at computer terminals, how do you check that you're not being watched, but do it in a way that doesn't make you look suspicious? Doing my best, I picked up the printout and carried it back to where Lenny and I were working. A while later, two campus cops charged into the room and rushed directly toward Lenny and me, shouting, "Freeze!" Apparently, I'd become notorious. They knew which of us was their real target, and they knew my name. Later, I learned that one of the administrators, John Solomon, had been at the same DECUS convention that Lenny and I had attended days earlier. John saw me in the computer lab and recognized me. He called Dave Compel, who had been part of the group that challenged me to break into DEC's RISTIS E development system when I was a student at Monroe High School. Compel told him to call the campus police and have me arrested. They grabbed the stack of printouts with all those passwords. Because I was already on probation, I knew this meant serious trouble. The cops hustled Lenny and me to their on-campus headquarters and handcuffed us to a bench, then disappeared into their offices, leaving us sitting alone next to the exit. After a little squirming, Lenny showed me his hands, free of the cuffs. He routinely carried a handcuff key in his wallet and had managed to retrieve it and free himself. He unlocked mine and said, "You've got more to lose, just take off." But how could I get away? The cops had taken my car keys, and besides, they knew who I was. One of the cops came back in. Behind my back, I snapped my cuff closed again. but the cop heard the sound and came over to take a closer look. "Hey, we've got Houdini here," he called out in the direction of the offices, while Lenny, unobserved, managed to drop the key onto the floor and kick it a few feet, where it became hidden beneath a car tire that for some odd reason had been left propped against the wall. Pissed, the cops demanded, "Where's the key?" They took each of us to the bathroom for a strip search and were mystified when they couldn't find it. Cops from the LAPD Bunko and Forgery Squad showed up and hustled me away. I was booked into jail at Parker Center, the LAPD headquarters. This time I was tossed into a holding cell with a couple of payphones inside. My first call was to my mom to tell her what had happened, and the next was to Aunt Chickie, pleading that she come bail me out as quickly as possible. Urgent, because I wanted to get to my car before the cops did, since it was, just as before, loaded with even more incriminating notes and discs. A colleague of hers got me out a few hours later, about 5 o'clock a.m. My much put-upon but ever-reliable mom was there to pick me up and drive me to the campus to retrieve my car. She was relieved that I was okay and hadn't been held. Whatever I might have deserved in the way of anger or scolding, that wasn't my mom's style. Instead, she was worried for me, worried about what would become of me. I was out on bail, but my freedom didn't last long. As I drove into work that evening, I phoned up my mom at Froman's Deli, where we were both then working, to ask if anyone had shown up looking for me. "Not exactly," she responded. Ignoring her cryptic response, I walked into work. My juvenile probation officer, Mary Ridgway, was waiting with two detectives. When she saw me, she announced that I was under arrest for probation violation, and the detectives gave me a ride to the juvenile detention center in Sylmar. Actually, going to Sylmar was a great relief. I was over 18 now, an adult in the eyes of the law, but since I was still on probation from juvenile court, I was still under its jurisdiction. I was handled the same way I would have been if I were still a juvenile. The distinction was lost on my mom. I was under arrest again, locked up. It was becoming a pattern. What was going to become of her dear son? Was I going to spend my life in and out of prison? She visited me and broke down in tears. She had done so much for me, and this was how I was repaying her, with misery and worry. It broke my heart to see her cry. How many times had I promised her I'd give up hacking, really, truly meaning it, but no more able to stick to my word than the alcoholic who keeps falling off the wagon? It turned out that the hacking that had landed me back inside was to have an even longer-lasting impact than I could have realized at the time. One of the accounts I had logged onto from the campus computer room was for someone who had a university account, but, in fact, worked at the Pentagon. When the police discovered that, they fed the story to the media, and the newspapers ran overblown articles mangling the facts, claiming I had hacked into the Department of Defense. Totally untrue, but a claim that still follows me today. I admitted to the charge of violating my probation and was sentenced to the custody of the juvenile authorities for 3 years and 8 months, the maximum term I could be given. But I was hooked, locked up and still looking for ways to beat the system. 5. All your phone lines belong to me. After sentencing, I was transferred once again to the facility in Norwalk for classification. I took refuge in the library and then realized it had a very good collection of law books. They became my new focus. A number of the kids in custody there wanted to file appeals or find out what rights they had, and I began lending a hand by doing research for them. At least I was doing some little good for others, and I found satisfaction in that. The library's collection turned out to include the procedural manuals governing the California Youth Authority. How convenient, I thought. They're going to let me find out how they're supposed to be doing things so I can look for flaws and loopholes. I dived in. I was assigned to a counselor who talked to me a few times and then drew up the recommendation that I be sent to Preston, the juvenile equivalent of San Quentin, a place full of the most dangerous, most violent kids in California's juvenile prison system. Why? I must have been one of the few white-collar criminals the juvenile system had ever handled. He even told me he picked the place partly because it was so far away, a 7 or 8 hour drive, meaning my mom and Graham would be able to visit only once in a while. Maybe he figured this middle-class kid had had all the opportunities that the tough guys from the inner city had never had, and instead of getting a college degree and a steady, well-paying job, I kept landing myself in trouble. And if he sent me to a dangerous, hardcore place, it might be enough to scare me into going straight. Or maybe he was just a malicious SOB misusing his authority. But what do you know? In the CYA procedural manuals, I found a list of the factors that must be taken into consideration in deciding which facility a youth should be sent to. He should be close to his family. If he was a high school graduate or had received a GED, he should be at a facility that offered college programs, which Preston certainly did not. The facility should be chosen based on his propensity for violence and whether he was likely to try to escape. I had never even been in a fist fight and had never attempted an escape. Underlying it all, according to the manual, the goal was rehabilitation. Great. I made copies of these pages. The grievance process also made for an interesting read. An inmate could ask for a series of hearings, ending with one at which an outside arbitrator came to listen to the facts and render an impartial, binding decision. I went through the stages of hearings. When the impartial arbitrator was brought in, members of the youth authority staff, 5 of them, presented their side of my case, complete with copied pages from their procedural manual to support their decision. A clever move, except they were using what I knew was an out-of-date copy of the manual, with provisions not nearly as favorable to me. When it came my turn to speak, I said, "Let me show you the current revision of the manual that these folks have not turned over to you." And I made a fervent appeal that I wanted to rehabilitate myself. The arbitrator looked at the dates on the pages that the counselor had submitted and looked at the dates on the pages from me. And he actually winked at me. He ordered them to send me to a facility with a college program. They sent me to Carl Holton in Stockton, east of San Francisco, still a very long way from home, but I felt I had won and felt very proud of myself. Looking back, I'm reminded of the lyrics from that Tom Petty song, "You could stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down." Carl Holton turned out to be, for me, the Holiday Inn of the California Youth Authority. Better living conditions, better food. Though it was a 5-hour drive, my mom and Graham came every other weekend, as before bringing loads of food. We'd cook steak or lobsters on the outdoor grills, like civilized people. And Mom and I would hunt four-leaf clovers on the lawn of the outdoor visiting area. Their visits helped make my time in custody feel shorter. The counselors would drop around to meet the parents, and mine really seemed extra polite to my mom. Other aspects of my stay didn't go as smoothly. The only razors allowed were the throwaway kind, forever nicking my skin, so I stopped shaving. My beard grew full and thick, completely changing my appearance. I would keep it only as long as I was inside. I was given early release after only 6 months. When my conditions of release document was being prepared, I was asked, "What condition can we put on you that you won't keep hacking?" How could I answer that? I said, "Well, there's ethical hacking and there's unethical hacking." "I need some formal language," was the reply. "What can I put down?" Star Wars came to mind. I said, "You could call it dark side hacking." That's the way it was entered into my conditions. No dark side hacking. I think it was an LA Times reporter who somehow came upon that term. It got picked up and widely reported by the press. It became a kind of nickname for me. Kevin Mitnick, the dark side hacker. After my release, a cop called me, giving his name as Dominic Domino, and explaining that he was the guy who had driven me to juvenile hall when I was picked up at Froman's. He was working on an LAPD training video about computer crime. Would I be willing to come in for an on-camera interview? Sure, why not? I doubt they're still using the production this many years later, but for a while, I was part of the effort to help LA cops learn about catching guys like me. At that time, Graham was sharing digs with a friend of hers, Donna Russell, who as a director of software development at 20th Century Fox was able to offer me a job. I thought, way cool, maybe I'll even rub shoulders with some movie stars. I loved that job. I worked right on the lot, walking past sound stages to get to my building. The pay was fair, They were training me in developing applications using COBOL and IBM's basic assembly language. Plus, I was learning about working with IBM mainframes and HP minicomputers. But all good things come to an end, they say. In this case, sooner rather than later. Another employee put in a grievance that, under union rules, the job should have been offered to current employees. After only 2 months, I was back on the street. Jobless. It came as a real shock one day when my parole officer, Melvin Boyer, called to say, "Kevin, have a big breakfast. Eat all you can, then come in to see me." That could only mean one thing. Trouble. In the ham radio world of Los Angeles, there was a repeater group on 147.435 megahertz that had been dubbed the Animal House. People would attack one another, use foul language, and jam other people's transmissions. For me, it was a game. I'd later learned that a guy in the Animal House group, who must have had some grudge against me, had called the Youth Authority parole office to complain I had hacked into his company's network. I hadn't. But the guy worked for Xerox, which I guess made him credible. Mom drove me in. The supervising parole agent asked me to accompany him to his office. He told my mom I'd be right back and said she should wait in the lobby. Instead, I was immediately handcuffed by the supervisor as they whisked me away out the side door to a waiting car. I yelled to my mom that they were sneaking me out the side and arresting me for something I hadn't even done. I was dropped off at the Van Nuys jail by my parole officer and his supervisor. By a weird coincidence, my Uncle Mitchell had called me from that same jail only a few weeks earlier. His life had been a skyrocket up and a plummet down. He had become a real estate multimillionaire, settled into a mansion in Bel Air, which is way more upscale than Beverly Hills, a number one address in all of L.A. But then he had discovered cocaine, which led to heroin, which, old story, led to the loss of house, fortune, honor, and self-respect. But at that point, I still had a lot of affection for him. The night when he called from the Van Nuys jail, I had said, "Do you want me to fix the payphone so you can make calls for free?" Sure he did. I told him, "When we hang up, get back on and dial 211-2345. That'll give you an automated announcement of the number of the phone you're using. Then call me back, collect, and tell me the number." When I had the number, the next step involved manipulating one of the phone company switches. From my computer, I dialed into the appropriate switch and changed the line class code on that phone to the code for a home telephone, which would allow incoming and outgoing calls. While I was at it, I added three-way calling and call waiting, and I programmed the phone so all the charges would go on the bill of LAPD's Van Nuys station. Now it was a week later, and where am I but at the same Van Nuys jail, where, thanks to my favor for Uncle Mitchell, I can make all the calls I want free. I stayed on the phone all night. Talking with my friends helped me escape the reality of where I was. Plus, I needed to find an attorney who could represent me because I knew it was going to be an uphill battle when I was sent back to face the California Youth Authority Parole Board. Parolees have very limited rights, and the board members would only need to believe I probably did whatever I was being accused of. The evidence didn't have to meet the standard of beyond a reasonable doubt as in a criminal trial. Then things went from bad to worse. They transferred me to L.A. County Jail, where I was greeted by being told to strip naked so they could spray me with insecticide. I was led to a dormitory that scared the hell out of me. I didn't know whom to be more frightened of, the really dangerous guys who looked like they'd steal an eyeball if they got the chance, or the crazy guys who could hurt somebody and not even know they were doing it. All the cots were already taken, leaving me no place to sleep. I just sat against the wall, struggling to keep my eyes open so when the sun came up, I'd still have all the possessions I arrived with. Boyer, my youth authority parole officer, told my mom, "L.A. County is a very dangerous place. He could get hurt there," and got me transferred the next day, back to Norwalk. If I saw Boyer today, I'd probably give him a big hug for that. I was 20 years old, but, thanks to the probation, still under the jurisdiction of the Youth Authority. This was my third time in Norwalk Reception Center. Some of the guards were like old friends. In my appearance before the parole board, they obviously didn't take the charge too seriously, maybe because there was no evidence but a report from the parole officer based on a single complaint. They held I disobeyed an order from the probation department to stop using my ham radio.
but it hadn't been a legal order. Only the FCC had the authority to take away my ham privileges. They gave me 60 days. By then, I had already been inside for about 57, so I was released a few days later. When my mom picked me up, I had her drive me to the L.A. Police Academy. I had heard they sold a license plate frame that supposedly was cop-friendly. A cop who saw it might not pull you over for a traffic infraction. In the store, I noticed a stack of books, the LAPD yearbook. I said I wanted one as a gift for my uncle, who's with the LAPD. It cost $75, but it was amazing, like finding the Holy Grail. It had the picture of every LAPD officer, even the undercover guys assigned to organized crime. I wonder if they still put that book out every year and sell a copy to anyone who shows up with cash in hand. A friend of my mother's, an entrepreneur named Don David Wilson, was running several companies under an umbrella firm called Franmark. He hired me to help with computer-related tasks, programming, data entry, etc. The work was boring, so for fun, excitement, and intellectual challenge, this won't surprise you, I turned back to hacking and freaking, often with my old phone freaker buddy Steve Rhodes, who would come over in the evenings to use the computers at Franmark. One day on the way to lunch with a young lady from work, I spotted a bunch of guys in suits who looked like cops, then recognized one as my parole officer and another as one of the guys who had searched my car years earlier for the logic bomb. I knew they weren't there for a social visit. Shit. My adrenaline started pumping, fear pulsing through me. I couldn't start running or walking fast without attracting attention, so I moved to put my back to the suits and pulled the gal into a big hug, whispering in her ear that I spotted an old friend and didn't want him to see me. We got into her car, still within sight of the group. I ducked down and asked her to please drive out in a hurry because I needed to make an important call. From a payphone, I dialed the LAPD's West Valley Division and asked to be transferred to records. "This is Detective Schaefer," I said. "I need to check a subject for any hits local and in NCIC, the FBI's National Crime Information Center. Mitnick, that's M-I-T-N-I-C-K, Kevin David. The subject's DOB is 86-1963. I pretty damn well knew what the answer was going to be. "Yes, I have a hit on him. It looks like a violation warrant issued by the CYA. Fuck. But at least they didn't get to arrest me. I called my mom and said, "Hey, I'm at 7-Eleven. We should talk." It was a code I had established with her. She knew which 7-Eleven and that I needed to talk because I was in trouble. When she showed up, I told her the story and that I needed a place to stay until I decided what I was going to do. Graham worked out with her friend Donna Russell, the lady who had hired me at Fox, that I could sleep on her living room couch for a few days. Mom drove me over there, stopping en route so I could buy a toothbrush, razor, and some changes of undershorts and socks. As soon as I was settled, I looked in the yellow pages for the nearest law school and spent the next few days and evenings there poring over the welfare and institutions code, but without much hope. Still, hey, where there's a will. I found a provision that said that for a nonviolent crime, the jurisdiction of the juvenile court expired either when the defendant turned 21 or 2 years after the commitment date, whichever occurred later. For me, that would mean 2 years from February 1983, when I had been sentenced to the 3 years and 8 months. Scratch, scratch, a little arithmetic told me that this would occur in about 4 months. I thought, what if I just disappear until their jurisdiction ends? I called my attorney to try out the idea on him. His response sounded testy. "You're absolutely wrong. It's a fundamental principle of law that if a defendant disappears when there's a warrant out for him, the time limit is told until he's found, even if it's years later." And he added, "You have to stop playing lawyer. I'm the lawyer. Let me do my job." I pleaded with him to look into it, which annoyed him, but he finally agreed. When I called back 2 days later, he had talked to my parole officer, Melvin Boyer, the compassionate guy who had gotten me transferred out of the dangerous jungle at L.A. County Jail. Boyer had told him, "Kevin is right. If he disappears until February 1985, there'll be nothing we can do. At that point, the warrant will expire, and he'll be off the hook." Some people are angels. Donna Russell contacted her parents, who had a place in Oroville, California, about 150 miles northeast of San Francisco. And, yes, they would be willing to take in a lodger who would help around the place, subsidized by monthly payments from his mom. I was on a Greyhound the next day for the long trip, which gave me time to pick up a temporary name for myself. Michael Phelps, the last name taken from the TV series Mission Impossible. A rumor, probably started by one of those reliable hacker